There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
Hello, everyone. Wild will be taking a pause for a few weeks over the Christmas period. And so we'll be running a bunch of my favourite episodes during this time, which you might have missed along the way. I know a bunch of you have watched the Netflix series Blue Zones, and some of you know that I worked on the project briefly and became friends with the National Geographic explorer Dan Boutner, who coined the term Blue Zones, wrote the book, and starred in the series. We actually caught up for dinner in Paris recently, and it's something we try to do regularly. We try to find each other in the world when we can, and we wind up talking not so much longevity, but how to maximize a life, whether it's short or long. I hope you enjoy this one. And look, if you're listening to this on a road trip, heading off on Christmas holidays or some such, and you're in the passenger seat, please do take a moment to rate Wild on your podcast app. Give it a review, share amongst your friends. It helps out a lot. So on the day his book went straight to Amazon number 2, I welcome you, Dan Boutner, to my humble and wild podcast.
Making number 2 on Amazon is not nearly the accomplishment of landing as landing on Sarah Wilson's Wild podcast. So right now is the summit.
You are still flattering me after all these years. Now, where in the world are you at the moment?
I'm on the southern tip of South Beach in Miami, Florida.
Yeah.
Kind of a blue zone, actually. I'm looking at the ocean.
Awesome. So how many interviews have you done today? I think I've got you at the end of the day. It's been a long day, right?
Yes, I think I've done 17 of them.
Oh.
All in preparation for this one.
There you go again. Now, look, I had to scroll back through the dusty files of the interwebs to work out when it was we actually met. And it was 2009 on my blog. Do you remember this? I somehow managed to insult you from afar by referring to your stupidly simple principles for living a long life. And I think you waded in and went, stupidly simple, hey, only took 7 years of my life to develop them. And then, do you remember? I think I then scrambled to explain that it's a turn of phrase that we use in Australia and that I'm really sorry and I have full respect for your work and blah, blah, blah. And then I think you came back and said that in the meantime, while I'd been scrambling around, you had Google searched me and worked out that we had quite a few things in common. Do you remember that?
I do. I remember meeting you coming to Australia for a speech. And I remember it was so cool because I knew you were a high-powered editor and journalist and you showed up on a bicycle, which immediately impressed me.
At a wine bar. We've always met at wine bars.
And plus you were unbelievably chic. So, it's a perfect combination in my book.
I think it was at that meeting that you invited me to Ikaria to do some work with you or at least be present while you were looking at the food habits on the island. And I ended up there for about 6 weeks, I think, in the end.
Yeah, that place sort of takes you in like an embrace and doesn't release you easily. Mm. And, I was just back there about 6 weeks ago. And, of course, they still remember you there, the famous Sarah Wilson, and that you made quite an impression on them.
They were beautiful hosts. I mean, Thea and Eleni, they totally took me in at a time in my life where I was pretty vulnerable. I mean, I found that experience pretty tough. I remember Eleni picked us up from the airport and she looked in the rear vision mirror at me and she's a tough nut, you know, and she said, Sarah, Ikaria, this island, it will either embrace you or it will spit you out. Either way, you have no choice.
That about sums it up. So imagine, so, you know, many people have gone to Ikaria searching for some insight into longevity. And many people have been completely transformed and changed their lives. And there's just something, you know, Blue Zones isn't about taking a pill or a supplement or a quick fix to live longer. It's about an environment, a lifestyle. And there's something about places where people are really living longer and better lives that, especially for those of us whose lives are imbued with worry and hurry and stress, to all of a sudden slow down and marinate in an environment where social interactions are more important than money and status, and people eat peasant foods and take time to enjoy a walk,
yeah,
instead of work out to get buff. It's just a different philosophy, but amazingly powerful on many levels.
Well, maybe we can kick off by you actually just listing off the five blue zones, just so that people know. These are areas in the world where people live the longest, I guess, have the most centenarians as well. So could you just list those off for us? They sort of still exist, sure. But yeah.
So, you know, the idea was funded by the National Institutes on Aging, our government, and on assignment for National Geographic, we set off to, in a sense, reverse engineer longevity. So in other words, instead of looking for a fountain of youth in a Petri dish or a test tube, we worked with demographers, and I think maybe you've met some of them, who expertise is looking at worldwide populations and parsing through census data. And what we're mostly looking for is the lowest rate of middle age mortality. Essentially, you know, people our age and maybe a little right around our age who have the best chance to reach a healthy age 93. People don't realize this, but making it to age 100, either in Australia or America or Europe, there's only about a 1 in 2,500 chance right now. But people listening right now with an average set of genes, if they do everything right, they ought to be able to hit 92 or 93. Both Australia and the United States were missing about a dozen of those years. And these blue zones are gaining the years. And this whole, you know, it's been an almost 15-year project now, has been to distill down exactly what these people are doing, what are the common denominators, and what are the lessons that people living in a modern world can take away and harness to get all the good years they deserve.
Yeah. So I remember when we were in Ikaria, I remember you telling me, I mean, there's only about 8,000 people on the island, but there are more than 90 people over the age of 100, and that might even be more now. Ikaria in Greece, it's an island in Greece, quite a remote one. It's regarded as wild, right? Like one of the wildest places in Greece.
Yeah, yes.
And the Greeks, when you tell them that you've been to Ikaria, they go, whoa, you know, like even in Greece, it's considered to be, you know, off the charts, kind of mad, because they just live very purely and freely. But what are the other four blue zones?
Island of Sardinia, the Nuoro province specifically, you have the highest concentration of male centenarians in the world. In the island archipelago of Okinawa, you have the highest proportion of female centenarians in the world, or concentration. The Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica, you have the lowest rate of middle age mortality. And what's remarkable about that place, they spend about 1/15th the amount we do on healthcare. So proof that you do not have to be rich to live a long time.
Yeah.
And then finally, in the United States, it's among the Seventh-day Adventists, who live about 8 to 10 years longer than their North American counterparts there.
So let's go to those 9 stupidly simple principles that you actually identified. You don't have to rattle them all off. People can actually go to your books to find those. But what are some of the main ones that you identified over the last 15 to 20 years looking into these blue zones?
Yes. So for one of my books, The Blue Zone Solution, I worked with Walter Willett, who I think you know from Harvard,
to do a
meta-analysis. So if you want to know what a centenarian ate to live to be 100, you have to know what they were eating as a child and a young adult and middle age and retired. You can't just ask a 100-year-old what they're eating because they don't remember. You know, if I asked you what you had for lunch a week ago Tuesday, you probably couldn't tell me. But by aggregating dietary surveys that have been done over the past 100 years in all blue zones, we see very clearly that 90 to 100% of all the calories they intake are whole and plant-based. They're eating mostly a complex carbohydrate diet, not simple. They don't eat a lot of sugar, almost no refined sugar, but the cornerstones of every longevity diet in the world are beans, greens, nuts, whole grains, and tubers, I would put, you know, sort of fifth. Sweet potatoes, yes. Yeah, the longest lived women in the world until 1970, two-thirds of their caloric intake came from purple sweet potatoes. So,
yeah, that's really interesting. It's interesting that you specify women because, you know, we've both traversed the era of the keto diet and the paleo diet and all of this kind of thing. And I've always had a problem with it. You know, you've had an issue with it as well, I know. But a big problem with it is that the studies have always been done on men, and women actually need a lot more carbohydrates, particularly in the form of these sort of sweet potatoes being identified as the best form of it.
I have no idea. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so women actually need carbohydrates to in that sort of beautiful form, i.e. it's, you know, as natural as they come. Women actually need these kinds of carbohydrates, these complex carbohydrates, to function best hormonally, which affects then, of course, every aspect of your health profile. So, yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that at all. So, yeah, so that's the dietary aspect. What else is there?
But also they have vocabulary for purpose. Ikigai in Okinawa, Planet Vida in Costa Rica, I think you felt the purpose, how it imbued the people in Ikaria. A very clever scientist from the National Institute on Aging named Robert Butler examined the writings of people retrospectively, and he found that those people who could clearly articulate their sense of purpose were living about 8 years longer than people who were rudderless. And, you know, I always say that if you could put purpose in a capsule, it would be a billion-dollar blockbuster drug. But it's not something we hear a lot about because it's very difficult for marketers to sell it to us. And I don't know about Australians, but there is a big purpose deficit in America right now. Only about a third of Americans actually find purpose in their work, according to Gallup. So knowing your sense of purpose, putting family first, keeping your aging parents nearby, investing in your partner, belonging to a faith. It doesn't matter what faith. It could be Christian or Jewish or Muslim, but it appears that people who are showing up four times a month live 4 to 14 years longer than people who don't go to church.
Wow.
And it may just be they have better social networks or maybe something as simple as they're less likely to engage in risky behavior. But being part of a faith seems to be a close in play strategy for adding years. I'm not
4 to 14 years. I mean, that's incredibly significant. It's interesting you say that we don't have a dialogue around that anymore. We used to. We very much used to. But I've mentioned this on the podcast before, that Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, he documents this from the perspective of who actually managed to survive Auschwitz and the concentration camps during the war. And the number one thing that he identified was a sense of faith and purpose beyond oneself. And generally it was either a belief in God or an absolute adherence to the family over your own interests.
Yeah.
It comes up throughout the traditional cultures. It comes up through religious texts, but we don't have a dialogue around it because today our purpose is driven by the dollar.
Yeah, or status, yeah.
Mm.
And, you know, so many people wake up in the morning and like, what am I here for? And what do I do? Does my job make any difference? And there's a certain existential stress that comes with that, that probably is triggering the inflammatory response. And you know, we don't exactly know why it's contributing to it. Maybe people with a strong sense of purpose are more likely to take their medicines, or they're more likely to stay active, or more likely to make an effort to eat healthy. But it's just such a strong correlation.
It's not causation, but correlation. I agree.
There's no causation here, but nothing you're going to hear today is causation. It's all strongly correlated. And but it is repeated in all five blue zones. And when you see the same correlation in five disparate populations, it tells you, you know, it starts to point at causation.
Yeah. No, I've read quite a number of studies that speak to that kind of sense of larger purpose piece in relation to a whole range of things, including anxiety, you know. And Eric Fromm refers to it as a moral aloneness that has gripped our culture, and it actually causes despair. I mean, in the US, you'd be aware of this, Dan, diseases of despair are such that it has brought the life expectancy of Americans down for 3 or 4 years in a row for the first time in recent history. Diseases of despair.
I totally believe that.
That stem from a moral aloneness. Yeah. So we've covered off two. Friendships, I think, is a really big one, isn't it? I think I remember reading about that years ago.
Yeah. So Nicholas Christakis did most of this work. He's at Yale now, but did the work at Harvard. And, you know, he found that health behaviors are as contagious among people as catching a cold or a flu. So in other words, if your best friends are drink too much, do drugs, are unhappy, are obese, that's all measurably contagious. So in blue zones, the circle of friends tend to be very strong. I use the Okinawan term often, the moai. A committed circle of four or five friends, but they tend to be people who reinforce the right behaviors. You see this very strongly among the Adventists. If your three best friends are sitting around watching television and huddled around the Barbie, you know, eating sausages and baby back ribs, well, you're probably going to eat and do the same thing. Whereas if your three best friends, their idea of recreation is bicycling or gardening or playing pickleball. If they care about you on a bad day, speaking of this disease of despair, it's a lot easier to have a positive mental attitude if you're surrounded by people who care about you and also have a positive mental attitude. And then, you know, we're big believers, you know, by looking at blue zones, that a whole plant-based diet, the closer you can get to that, it's not a restricted, but a vegetarian or vegan in your immediate social network is going to show you not only where to find delicious plant-based food, but also often show you how to make it. And therein lies the real secret to eating healthier. You know, it's not restricting yourself. It's not measuring your calories. It's not bucking up and having this heroic discipline for the next 40 years. It's finding this healthy food that you love, and nobody has to convince you anymore.
Well, that actually brings us quite conveniently to the wild idea that I identify, particularly in your latest book, after 15 to 20 years of watching this, living in these countries, delving down deeper and deeper into the specifics of it all. Where you have arrived at is, and I think it's pretty wild, I think it's pretty cool, it totally gels with my thinking around these kinds of things, is that you don't need to change your individual behavior. So it's not about willpower for sticking to a diet or muscling your way through a gym workout and getting the proper, you know, routine in place. It's about changing your surroundings. So instead of changing yourself, you change your surroundings. Can you explain that?
Yes. So, I mean, most diets and exercise programs that are pitched to us constantly, especially around the New Year's, expect us to remember to do something, to muster discipline, to have self-control for years and decades. And I'll tell you one thing for sure, when it comes to longevity, there's nothing you can do for the next few weeks or few months that's going to have any impact on how long you live at all, short of not dying. So when you think of longevity, you need to think of things that are going to help you do the right things for decades, for long enough, so and avoid the wrong things so you don't develop a chronic disease. By the way, the type of longevity that Blue Zones discusses is not increasing the capacity of the human machine. The human machine is built, as far as we know, on average, to hit mid-90s. So there's nothing I can tell you that is going to tell you how to live to 100. But the average listener here should be able to make it to 92 or 93. The only way we're going to do that is doing the right thing for long enough. in blue zones, nobody at age 50 is saying to themselves, well, darn it, I'm going to get on that longevity diet and live another 50 years. They're not joining CrossFit. They're not taking supplements. They're not expecting their willpower to carry them through. They simply live in environments where the healthy choice is not only easy, that's become kind of a cliche, but it's unavoidable. Mm. And therein lies the secret, I believe, in both of our countries at producing not only a healthier population, but a happier population.
So what you're talking about is structures that essentially nudge people in this direction where it just becomes subconscious. They don't even have to think about it. It's correct. Just what you do.
Right. So the Cornell Food Lab found that we make on average about 220 food decisions a day.
Wow. You know,
what are we going to have for lunch? Are we going to have a vegetable side? Are we going to put salt on? Are we going to put hot sauce on? Are we going to have milk or fruit juice or water? Only about 10% of those food decisions are conscious. So even if you found the willpower and presence of mind to govern those conscious decisions for long enough, you still have the unconscious decisions. And what this book I wrote, you know, came out this week, The Blue Zone Challenge, I've harvested from the academic literature about a half a dozen ways for you to engineer your unconscious decision, those 90% that we food decisions, to make them better, not only consuming fewer calories, but consuming better calories.
Well, I saw a few of them because obviously the book's just come out and I had to scan a PDF at warp speed this morning before we spoke after a swim in the ocean, I've got to say. So I know that you're a big fan of the slow cooker. And look, off air, I'll give you my rant on the slow cooker. I might just touch on a few of them here. Uses less electricity than a light bulb, preserves all the nutrients because it's cooked at such a low heat, and it's a dump and run solution.
I love that, dump and run.
you can't stuff up a slow cooker meal. You really, really can't. And if you must, you can throw frozen peas in. A handful of frozen peas at the end will generally fix any slow cooker meal that might not have the right flavor. But there's some others. I mean, I think one of the nudges that I read about was removing the toaster from your kitchen bench.
Yeah, again, this is a Cornell Food Lab. So they followed two groups of people who started with, you know, at a base light weight. And the people who didn't have a toaster on their counter or their kitchen bench weighed 6 pounds or about 3 kilos less after 2 years than people who kept the same thing, by the way, with a with junk food. If you keep chips or on the kitchen bench with a clip on them, it's a nudge. I like to joke that we're all on a seafood diet. We tend to eat the food we see. And one of the easiest ways to engineer unnecessary calories out of our diet is to set up your kitchen so the unhealthy calories are out of the way. So, and the prompts are out of the way. So putting the toaster away, establishing a junk food drawer where you have to stoop down, reach high, or go around the corner. These all have measurable techniques to engineer calories out of your kitchen experience.
And some of the foods that you recommend, I mean, I know that you famously, well, you love beans, but you've identified that they'll add 4 years to your life. Is that right?
Yeah. So one study done in the Mediterranean that followed about 1,000 people people who are eating about a cup of beans a day are living about 4 years longer. Of course, that's different depending on your age. But you know, Sarah, I wrote recently a story for National Geographic magazine. They're very careful about their facts, about the diet of longevity. It was about a year and a half ago now. But I spoke to, I believe, the top nutrition academics in the world, not just the United States, but a lot of them in Europe. Some in Australia. And it seems the component of our diet that's largely been overlooked, you know, we tend to be obsessed about protein and carbohydrates, you know, and all fat. We have about 100 trillion bacteria in our guts. It weighs about 3 kilos, by the way. It's arguably the biggest organ in our body. And if they're fed right, they produce something called short-chain fatty acids, which fine-tune our immune system. They mute inflammation. They even govern your mood positively. The only thing those healthy bacteria consume and pay us back so handsomely is fiber. They don't consume fat. They don't consume carbohydrates. They don't consume protein. And the standard American diet is almost completely devoid of fiber. So my breakfast every day, I actually make a Sardinian minestrone, which is very similar to the longevity stews that we were eating in Icaria. There's two or three types of beans. There's celery, carrots, onions, garlic. There's barley in there. When you combine beans and barley, you get a whole protein. I finish it with a little extra virgin olive oil.
Just a little?
Tablespoon.
There's
probably 25 strains of fiber there. And, you know, we have about 1,000 strains of bacteria in our gut. They like different kinds of fiber. So, you know, I feed my microbiome every morning first thing. But also when you're eating beans, it's a slow burn food. We know that people eat beans, their appetite is satiated for about 4 hours as compared to, you know, eating cereal, which often has sugar in it, or even eggs and bacon. They tend to make you sluggish. So I like to start my day with a breakfast that's going to sustain me and my microbiome. And I find that in Sardinian minestrone.
That bacteria piece is also very related to anxiety. So serotonin now is seen to be mostly produced in the gut. So 70 to 90% of it is produced in the gut.
Is that right?
That's right. And so we now identify that, you know, if you have fire in your gut, you have fire in the brain. So if you're getting inflammation in the gut from not eating enough fiber and you've got too much of the wrong bacteria, it will actually go up into the brain and cause inflammation, which then causes anxiety. So all of this stuff interlinks, all of the stuff that you and I have been working on for years very much feeds into each other. Are there any specific beans that are better than others, if we can get a little bit granular with it?
There's some small argument for black beans because they have the same antioxidants as blueberries. You know, nuts also, people who eat a handful of nuts live 2 years longer, and people ask what are the healthiest nuts. And I say, The best nut is the nut you're going to eat, and the best bean is the bean you're going to eat for the long run. So most of the time that involves switching it up pretty regularly.
Yeah. And for me, look, I have issues digesting both nuts and legumes. What works for me, for anyone who's out there listening and also has some gut issues, I find chickpeas and red lentils to be particularly soothing. Make sure you rinse, soak, and cook them properly. And then nuts, I find Brazil nuts to be particularly good. They're very easy to get organic and they contain high levels of selenium, which is wonderful for thyroid health. So they're the ones I go for. I find cashews and peanuts problematic, but there you go. Red wine. Can we get to red wine? Because this is the good news piece of it all. And you and I have always felt, intuitively, that red wine is a great thing. Yeah. And when we're talking red wine, we're talking the really robust ones. I mean, there's the Sardinian one, the Cananao, that is particularly good. It's almost like the more resveratrol, the more tannins, the better, right? I think you're just cutting to a fridge right now. There we go. Is that from Sardinia, that one?
Yeah, it's from Sardinia. It's a Cananao, and they call this Vino Nero, which means black wine, because
you can eat it with a knife and fork.
You remember. Yeah, so it turns out that most of the antioxidants, and there's another one called procyanid, which has been shown to reduce inflammation of the endothelium, or the lining of the arteries. And that is produced actually in the skin as a reaction to sunshine, radioactivity. And the grapes grown in Sardinia are at high altitude, and they get 330 days of sun every year. So they react by turning very red. Vino Nero, black wine, and the Cananao, the skins and the seeds are macerated for 15 days. So all that good stuff from the skin ends up actually in the wine. And they drink a little bit every day. And when I say a little bit, there may be a little bit at 10 in the morning, a little bit with lunch, a small glass, just a 2-ounce glass or something with their friends after work, and then a little bit with dinner. And I know there's a lot of controversy around should you drink or should you not, but I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that people in most of the blue zones are enjoying a little bit of wine or some other fermented spirit every day as part of a social ceremony or accompanying their food.
And that's the point, isn't it? It's the social aspect and it's also the food aspect, because I personally find a glass of red wine helps me digest my food in the evening. And I have one glass of red wine, I would say 5 or 6 nights a week. And it for me is, it actually really does help me process my food. It makes sure my whole gastrointestinal tract is relaxed. And then if I'm with friends, it's a really nice way to arrive in the moment together, especially when we live frenetic lives. You know, it shifts gears. I'm happy not to drink more than that. And I've always had a belief that if you allow a glass of wine, rather than putting the no, you must not drink it, then you can actually modulate things far better. I think you can actually practice moderation when you allow yourself that grace. And within those kind of rituals, I mean, it's the ritual around drinking that is, I think, very particular to those blue zones as well. They don't drink to get drunk.
That's right. They're not drinking shots of tequila. Although Cipro every once in a while will inspire certain behaviors in Icaria, but
the panieri, I mean,
yeah,
that's next level. Although they do water their wine down with water, don't they? It's kind of half and half.
And it with goat liver
And pork broth. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
You know, these old ladies would wander around with vats of pork broth because they felt that absorbed it.
Yeah, about 4 in the morning after you've been drinking and dancing for 6 hours, then the goat livers and the pork broth come around. But
isn't it incredible? Those panieri are just surreal, aren't they? In summer, just so that everybody listening understands, these are these parties that every village has one of them. You know, every little tiny village across the island will have these parties and they're free. The entire island is invited to come along and the locals just donate their wine and their pork and their livers. And, you know, the village priest will be there at 5 in the morning. There'll be 3-year-olds wandering around at 2 in the morning. They're generally outdoors in the forest and they're a wild celebration that will go for 48 hours. And it sounds like, gosh, you could only do one a summer. They back it up, don't they?
Yeah, there's about 90 of them a season. And the other beautiful part about it, and this gets to the bigger ethos of Blue Zones, people.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Donate the wine and the food, but then they charge a little bit. You know, you weigh your food by the kilo and they do charge you by the carafe of wine. But all that money then goes for a family that needs it or to prepare a school or to build a bridge. It goes back to the community. So there's this beautiful virtuous circle. It's not just a bacchanal to get drunk. It is the songs they sing are about their history, about getting free from Turkey. And it reinforces social bonds, builds new bonds, always does some social good. And I happen to know that some of the activities immediately following these panieris suggest rebuilding the forthcoming generation.
Right. What do you mean by that?
Well, it happens in the weeds.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that innuendo. Yeah, right. Okay. So a mating ritual is what you're trying to say.
Yes. I was trying to be circumspect.
No, I just didn't get it. Sorry, I didn't help you out there. One of the things I also came across in your next book, because your book actually works through a bunch of challenges so that you can access these secrets to longevity and you can start to implement them into your own life. So you've talked about some nudges in and around food. The friendship piece is an interesting one, especially in our cultures, right? Because I think you make the point that in our culture, most people have not added a friend to their circle in 5 years. Is that right?
Well, I know in the United States in the 80s and 90s, the average American had 3 friends. We're now down to under 2.
Gosh.
And loneliness, we know, is if you have fewer than 3 friends you can count on a bad day, it's a technical definition of loneliness. Lonely people live about 7 years shorter lives than people who are well connected. You know, this book, this Blue Zone Challenge, you know, I'm more like you, I'm more of a journalist, I never set out to be sort of a health guru, but, you know, the first book, Blue Zones, it took me 5 years to write, and I think I captured pretty well what the world's longest lived people do. Blue Zone Solution, I think, captured pretty well about, things that keep it working in their lives. And this Blue Zone Challenge is specifically harnesses the available science to get people to shape their surroundings for the long run so they don't have to think about it. So it's, it's intentionally 4 weeks. So we know people will keep their intention for about 4 weeks. It's intentionally timed around the 1st of January because people are making resolutions. And I would say to your question, the most disruptive section of this is about curating your social circle. As I mentioned before, obesity is measurably contagious. And while I would not tell you to dump your old unhealthy friends, I will tell you that proactively finding two or three healthy people, ideally doing this challenge with them, but if nothing else, finding these healthy people and doing what they do, is one of the best things you can do for your overall health. Because once again, friends tend to be long-term adventures. You and I have been friends for 12 years. You've influenced me in many ways. My sugar consumption is way down because of I quit sugar. And we've hung out enough, and you're just being with you has had a contagious nature to it for me. So essentially what I'm saying is the best thing you can do this January is find two or three Sarah Wilsons to surround yourself with. And,
God forbid. I don't recommend that.
I do. She's very humble, but she's a blast.
What are some examples of how people have done that? Because I know that you've studied it, but also probably in doing this press tour, you've managed to hear some really great stories. I mean, the Okinawan people call them
a moai,
which is, these social groups of sort of 5 to 10 people, and you do activities with them. And I think that's really quite important, is the activity aspect as opposed to the just kind of, bumming out on the couch. What are some examples that you've heard, just to give people a really good feel for it?
You know, my business, I'm hired by American Cities to lower the obesity rate, and I get paid by insurance company. I have 200 people in this company now, and we've been in 50 cities. And one of the things we do is we bring sometimes up to 500 people together. We circle them up and we ask them a number of questions. We ask them to look at each other as people are answering these questions and pay attention to people who answer the questions like us. And we'll ask questions like, raise your hand if you've seen a Disney movie lately. Raise your hand if your idea of a perfect vacation is hiking, going to Caribbean beach, or staying at home. And there is this term in psychology known as homophily. Human beings tend to like other human beings who are like them, who share values, who share interests, who share demographics. So, one of the best places to start is to find people who you think are like you, and then organize your meetings around a healthy activity. And when we do this in cities, we make it very simple. It's simply walking together or eating plant-based meals together. So then you build this social network around a healthy activity, and that makes it long lasting and therefore offers a real promise of adding years to our lives. But there's other ways to do it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Dan. During lockdown, I came across various Facebook groups that were set up all around reaching out to strangers and saying, look, I need someone to walk with. Who would like to walk with me at such and such a time from here to there twice a week? And then I found myself doing something similar. I, mostly out of lockdown, as soon as we could actually venture out into to bushland again, I got a group of people together and just said, hey, I go hiking once or twice a month. Who would like to come? I'm just going to send out the dates and where I'm going. And it's always on public transport. We meet at the central station and, you know, I invite people to bring their coffee in a keep cup, to bring healthy snacks, and we walk and we generally have a topic to talk about, invariably climate. But yeah, these
guys.
Yeah, these groups, and it's always 4 to 5 women that join me, and I've done about 4 or 5 of them now.
That, Sarah, that is incredibly powerful, and I'll tell you why. Walking offers about 90% of the benefits of training for a marathon, and in fact, if you're older than 30 or 40, exerting yourself can actually be a big negative. So gentle, low-intensity physical activity is what we see in the Blue Zone. You're building a social network. You're talking out your problems. You're probably having meaningful conversations. It's enjoyable, so you're more likely to do it for months or years at a time, as compared to, you know, CrossFit, where you completely exhaust yourself. And you know, it's the last thing you want to do after a hard day is go do that again. So it's one of these subtly powerful things that we tend to overlook in the onslaught of marketing messages that are trying to sell us some other program.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, as you know, I'm a massive, massive hiker and one of my favorite factoids, and there's about 40,000 studies that have been done to show why hiking in nature works from a health point of view, from a mental health point of view, and from also establishing a connection with meaning. One of my favorites is this idea that walking goes at the same pace as our ability to have discerning thought.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we emerged as humans vertical, you know, from all fours up to vertical beings. And our prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that controls discerning thought, which is able to sort of back away from the amygdala, which is the primal fight or flight kind of mechanism, which causes anxiety, it emerged as we got upright. And so it emerged to the left-right motion as we walked around the savannas and the, you know, the forests and the early jungles. And that is a really important thing to access. So for anyone who wants to access a more meaningful life, which is of course one of your principles, walking is just that, you know, it goes straight to it. It's kind of a quadruple whammy effect, isn't it? I mean, it just ticks off all the boxes. But Dan, why don't we move on to some of the benefits of those, I think, cities around America that you've worked with where you've applied these Blue Zone principles. And I'd love for you to just rattle off some brag statements about some of the achievements that you achieved in these cities.
Yeah, so Fort Worth, Texas, one of the least healthy cities in the world, in the United States rather, moved up out of the 162 ranking. They were 157. We moved them up to about 45. So their obesity rate dropped by 6%. Their smoking rate dropped by about 9%. This is a city of 1 million people. In the beach cities of Los Angeles, we saw a 15% drop in BMI, which meant 1,900 fewer obese people in a population of 120,000. People reported about 20% higher levels of life satisfaction. Fort Worth, they also, according to Gallup, saw about $250 million of per year savings in projected healthcare costs because of the work there. And we measured in every city. We've been in 54 of these cities, and we never come in and try to convince an entire population to change their behavior. We come in with 3 squads. One squad works with city council. And by the way, we only come into a city if the public sector and the private sector specifically invite us in with pledging to follow what we ask them to do. So we really take over an entire city. And we help them with their food policy to favor fruits, vegetables, nuts, and beans over fast food and sodas and junk food, to favor the pedestrian and cyclist over the motorist, to favor the non-smoker over the smoker. And we can usually get a half a dozen or so policies passed in the 5 year in each of those categories, which make a huge difference. And then we have a second squad that fans out and goes to every grocery store, workplace, school, restaurant, and church and offers them Blue Zone certification for optimizing their policies and their designs to nudge people into moving more, eating fewer, healthier calories, living their purpose, and connecting socially. And then we have a third squad that gets to about 15% of the adult population. We help them optimize their home environment. We help them join these MOIs, you know, create these social circles. And then we give them a free purpose workshop that helps them do an internal assessment of their values and what they're good at. And then we offer them a curated volunteer opportunity. And we know that volunteers, by the way, have a lower BMI, fewer heart attacks, and actually measurably lower healthcare costs. So this is a convergence of people, places, and policies. They're all permanent environmental changes. So we can come in, do our work for 5 years, get out, and the effect can last for decades.
So what are some of the structural things? Are we talking you put in bike lanes in or put in pedestrian malls and take over streets? Is that the kind of thing? And what's been most effective?
Exactly what you said. So we have on our team a guy named Dan Burden, who was one of Time Magazine's civic designers of the century. And his expertise is policies that help cities design their streets, not just for cars, as they've been done for the past 40 years, but also for humans. And it isn't that we come in and we ask the city to rip up all their pavement and put in bike lanes and sidewalks. There's a complete streets policy bundle, it's called. About once every 7 years, streets need to be redone. And this policy simply says the next time a street gets ripped up, a bike lane needs to go in, a sidewalk needs to be widened. You need to make sure that it's safe for pedestrians to cross. And also what's really huge is trees. Planting trees not only invite pedestrians, but there's actually good research that it raises the value of homes sitting adjacent to those walkable streets.
Well, here's a factoid for you. Studies done out of the US, and I can put these in the show notes, the actual links to the studies, show that when you have trees growing in a local area, it actually has a well-being dollar value of $10,000 per person. So you would have to spend $10,000 per person a year to get the same well-being uplift from simply planting a whole heap more trees. Also, trees reduce the amount of violence in a neighborhood. And I think that was a study that was done out of Utah, but again, I'll put it all in the show notes. But there's countless studies showing how a neighborhood that has trees has all kinds of health benefits.
Yeah, and the air is cleaner too. Mm. But you know, we evolved with trees in the forest. Things that we evolve with tend to be good for us. Just like, you know, the Blue Zone diet's essentially the diet that hunter and gatherers were eating most of human history. So it's not a processed or an artificial food. They're eating the same thing our ancestors have been eating for thousands of years.
I just want to pick up on some of the things that you may have put in place at a structural level for these cities when it comes to food, because I've done all kinds of work trying to work with school canteens, trying to work with sports venues in and around getting sugar out of the canteens and the only available food that people can eat when they're at a sporting event and so on. And I've found it almost impossible. So I'm intrigued as to what you have been able to get across the line in these cities.
So let me tell you the secret.
Please.
Nobody wants to be told what to do. Mm-hmm. And if you come in pontificating, you're not going to get far. We come in with bundles. So to get Blue Zone certification for a school, we come in with 25 evidence-based things a school can do to create a healthier school day for children. And we tell them, you don't have to do any of these, but if you want Blue Zone certification, get 3/4 of them done. And things that work, like a school lunch in the United States is subsidized by the government. It's very hard to change that. You're not going to have much luck. But things that you can do that if you put the fruits and vegetables at the front of the line, children choose more of them and eat, therefore eat more of them. We can often get schools to take all of these sugar-sweetened beverages out of vending machines and replace them with water. And we've been very successful in that. But the most important, the most powerful thing you can do in the food environment in a school is change one simple cost-free policy. And that is not allowing children to eat in hallways and classrooms. And that simple default lowers the BMI of a school by about 21%, because you're engineering out, you know, kids aren't bringing healthy food to school. They're eating the chips and the M&Ms and the Cokes and the power drinks and so forth. If the only food they can eat is what they get in the cafeteria, at least you're eliminating a lot of the junk food.
And they're eating proper meals where they're surrounded by people sitting down to eat a proper meal at the required time, as opposed to snacking mindlessly because they can.
Correct.
That is awesome. I'd never actually thought of that. That's incredible. I suppose I really need to ask, how do you live it all? I observe you. We have our phone catch-ups every couple of months where we touch base on, I don't know, the details, the flavors, the intricacies of life. But yeah, how are you living your life at the moment to some of these principles? What are you incorporating into your life that has meaningful effect?
I weigh the same amount I do as I did in high school, and I eat, you know, I weighed about 20 pounds more 20 years ago. I eat pretty much a whole food plant-based diet, and I try not to eat refined sugars. It's very hard, you know, in our food supply. I know that being socially active is not only good for my longevity, it's good for my happiness. So I'm naturally an extrovert, and I let my give free range to my proclivities. I'm very clear on my sense of purpose, and I live it every day. Pretty much every, you know, my purpose or what I'm good at, what I love to do, where I find meaning is exploring our world, focusing mostly on the traditional people, learning from their wisdom and putting their wisdom to work in other people's lives. That's what I wake up every morning and do, and I'm satisfied, and it's provided me a very great living. And the other thing I'm absolutely convinced of, your life expectancy is more a function of your zip code or your neighborhood than just about anything else. So I very proactively, I live on the southern tip of South Beach. It's a very walkable community. I live right on the ocean, so I swim almost every day in the ocean. There's healthy, the Whole Foods, grocery stores, healthy grocery stores within 12 blocks of my house. I ride my bike almost everywhere. I bump into friends. It turns out that the serendipitous social interactions, the low quality social interactions we have throughout the day, is more predictive of longevity than even long exercise and diet. So running into the postman, talking to your barista, seeing your neighbor out in the street. These things, totally environmentally driven, and we know contribute to longevity. So I intentionally put myself into these environments.
Which was such a difficult thing for so many people during these lockdowns around the world, you know, during the pandemic, because we were denied those social interactions with the everyday people we meet in our community. And I know for me, I live on my own, and so I was in lockdown with my foster child, but my sense of meaning and belonging and well-being comes from those interactions on the street, from walking. And of course, when you're walking, it's the only way to have those interactions. You can't do it when you're driving and running from one car park to another.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think in an email interaction we had just lining up this interview, you mentioned also that you're pondering the art of life and finding the sweet spot between, I suppose, being productive and purposeful and enjoying the juiciness of what life has to offer. And I think that's the eternal search, isn't it, for most humans, for most conscious and thinking humans. How are you navigating it at the moment, Dan?
Well, believe it or not, I'm over 30, and I've had enormous success with, you know, all these books and Blue Zones. And at a certain point, you realize, well, I don't really need more money, but I do like to be relevant. I do like to be living my purpose. But there's also something to be said for enjoying life and finding those things that give you some pleasure and that allow you to savor life. So some of the things I try to never work past 4 p.m. I work a little bit every day. I make sure I get at least an hour to 2 hours of physical activity, and I do something I enjoy. The days are gone. As you know, I hold 3 world records in cycling. I can conjure the discipline if I need it, but now my rule is I do something every day that I enjoy. In fact, you let me get on this podcast a half hour late, and I'm going to admit to you right now, is because I was playing pickleball.
What is pickleball? What is pickleball?
It's the bastard child of tennis and ping pong. You know, it's played on a court about half the size of a tennis court, but it's very fast. It's very social. It's almost always played with 4 people. And it's very fun. Fastest growing sport in America right now.
Huh.
And I'm obsessed with it. And so that's what I was doing.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So pickleball and riding your bike. Yeah. What else? I mean, what else are you saying that you enjoy? Because a lot of people find it very hard to actually navigate what they enjoy, because we live in a world where we are so focused on attending to duty. And it's not necessarily a duty that befits our sense of what matters, nor does it necessarily serve other people, other loved ones in our lives in a particular way. It generally is geared towards being productive in the mechanics of the capitalist cycle. So people find it very hard. How have you navigated what you enjoy doing?
Well, there's 2 categories of things I enjoy doing. You know, one is probably unhealthy and the other one's healthy. And if you get clear on the things you enjoy that are also good for you, man, you can do those all day long. I will tell you, I enjoy a sip of tequila every now and again.
I know you do.
Often a sip gets another sip, and sometimes, you know, I can get in trouble. But I do love a long dinner. I love hosting dinner parties. You know, and so the way I spend my money is I always pick up the tab and I host. I get good chefs and I invite people, and I seed the dinner party with the question. Everybody, if they want to come, they need to be ready with an answer to the question. We have long discussions. I think that's good for my social life. It's good for my soul, and I serve good food, so it's good for that. I'm a big believer in saying yes to social invitations, so I always try to put that first and work second. I also find that work gets itself done. You know, most of what we need to really get done gets done. And, you know, I wrote a cover story for National Geographic on happiness.
I remember.
And the happiest places in the world, the highlands of Costa Rica and Aarhus, Denmark, they work about 35 hours a week. And maybe they don't become a billionaire or a multimillionaire, but they're reporting the highest life satisfaction and positive affect on earth. So I think the sweet spot is probably 30 hours of work a week, an hour or two of physical activity every day that you enjoy. Most people, believe it or not, according to Cornell Sleep Lab, need between 8 and 9.5 hours of sleep. So I try to never set an alarm unless I absolutely have to. And the happiest people, and again, this is a correlation, the happiest people are getting 6 to 7 hours of social interaction every day, not Facebook, but face-to-face interactions in the presence of another human.
Wow, 6 to 7 hours. I suppose a lot of people live in families, and if they're engaged with their children and their partner, that would satisfy that aspect of things. But, yeah, that's a reality check for someone like me who lives on my own, and I'm an introvert. I mean, I know that you and I have clashed where you're like, come on, Sarah, let's go out, and I'm like, no, I just need to stay still. that's a good reminder.
But believe it or not, you know, introverts are actually happier with people than they are without, but they just don't like it for as long.
And are more selective about who they spend that time with.
Probably that too. But, you know, we evolved as a social creature, and there's something satisfying about human connection that, you know, we're connecting socially right now, even though we're on opposite ends of the planet.
Mm, and I know you quote Vivek Murthy in your book. He wrote a book about connection that came out right in the middle of the pandemic. He was the Surgeon General to the Obama administration.
And by the way, he's back. He's our Surgeon General again.
Under Biden. Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, so he wrote a book called Together, if I have that right. And he talked about the fact that, of course, We can emulate that social connection on a Zoom call or a Zencaster call from the other side of the world if we have eye contact and if we're talking about meaningful stuff.
Yes.
And so I think that's really encouraging in a world where a lot of my friends, my meaningful friends, are on the other side of the world, and you're one of them, Dan.
Thank you.
The conversations that we have...
they have emotional contact.
Sometimes it will be 6 months apart.
Yeah.
And they satisfy me. They fill my cup.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you sense we both... you know, care about each other. Where I think when it comes to friendship, longevity counts for a lot. And the fact that, you know, 12 years we've been in contact with each other and seen each other half a dozen times and care about each other and are really interested in what's going on with our lives. You know, it'd be great if we could be sitting across the table with a glass of wine, but I would argue this is the second best thing and a hell of a lot better than nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, on that note, why don't we leave it there and aim to go for a hike and have a nip or two of tequila down the track somewhere. You choose where I'll be there. I'll map out the route and pack the backpacks, probably within an inch of their life of efficiency. Yeah, thanks as always, Dan. It was an awesome opportunity to just see you again.
It's great to see you too, Sarah. And, you know, if any of your audience has other questions, I'm at Dan Buettner, and I answer every DM people send me, so I'd be happy to answer questions I might not have touched on. And I take your challenge to meet somewhere in the world for a hike as part of your next book.
Well, from that chat, there's a hell of a lot we can all take away, and I think it all feels intuitively right. It makes sense, and people for eons have been living this way, and it works. Cassie and I, my producer, we put together a bit of a list of the stuff that we took from it. So just to remind you, if you want to take these notes away with you, get a slow cooker. I mean, I've been talking about this for years and I gave you my rant. Remove the toaster from your kitchen bench. That's awesome. It essentially means you're not going to go and eat cheap carbohydrates three meals a day. Eat beans. It'll add 4 years to your life. Eat nuts. It'll add 2 years to your life. Drink red wine, and the redder and the more robust, the better. So Cannonau is the variety that we talked about. It's from Sardinia. It is incredibly alcoholic and it's incredibly red. Sweet potato. Eat sweet potato, particularly women, because you heard Dan refer to the fact that women who ate more sweet potato added years to their lives. So women in particular. Ensure that you have a notion of what the purpose to your life might be. And that takes time. It's not something that, you know, we are encouraged in our culture to think about. But I think there's so many books out there that can bring you into that space and, of course, groups that can actually help you access that. And it might be through a religious faith, something to that effect. And I think he threw in there that having a faith of some sort can add 4 to 14 years to your life. And for me, I'm not a religious type, but my spiritual faith is nature. That's where I find my sense of purpose and my sense of belonging in the world. Learn to make friends as an adult. And I can see around me that so many people have fewer and fewer friends. Loneliness kicks in as we get older. And the two tips that he had that were research-based is to start a walking group. And that's a pretty easy thing to do. To reach out to someone and go, do you want to go for a walk? Or a cooking group, which is an awesome idea. It's a great way to connect. Volunteer. And he mentioned that being a volunteer generally lowers your BMI, which, you know, might be a carrot to add to things. Your postcode matters. So if you have the opportunity to choose where you get to live at some stage, look for places that have nature. It might be the ocean, it might be a park nearby that you can go and hike in on a regular basis, and a place where it encourages pedestrians. That, I think, is something that I've prioritized in my life. I've foregone a lot of other things to live in those kinds of places around the world. Work 30 hours a week if you can, and I think this is where the world needs to head from a number of different perspectives, and we're going to be talking about that in a forthcoming episode. This is probably the one that stopped me in my tracks. Dan suggested that we need to be getting 6 to 7 hours of social time face to face every day. I struggle to get half an hour, I think, but as Cassie said to me as we signed off from Dan, you know, I am out in the world. I'm out talking to baristas and people in the street. I know most of the old salties that do the ocean swim in the morning. that counts. And I suppose if I don't have a family living with me where I have that kind of interaction, I can find it elsewhere. And now that we're out of lockdown, that has helped me enormously. I'm sure many of you listening can relate to that. Get 1 to 2 hours of movement every day. You know what? I've always said it. If you want to get healthy, get rid of your car. It forces you to walk everywhere. It really is effective from a range of different angles. He also threw in there, never set an alarm. And I do the same thing. If you can incorporate some of those into your life, it's essentially about changing your surroundings. It's not about a restrictive, didactic diet, which you probably won't stick to. Anyway, until next week, stay wild.